I call this meeting of the Committee on Housing and Finance Policy to order. Let it be known that we have quorum. First order of business for the day, members. If I could have a motion to approve last meeting's minutes. Representative Mecklen moves the minutes. Is there any discussion to the minutes? All those in favor of the minutes signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The minutes are approved. All right, so today we are going to continue working through the Yes to Homes package of bills that we have in front of us. The first bill we have on the agenda today will be House File 2140, and I make the motion that House File 2140 be referred to the Committee on Elections, Finance, and Government Operations. Welcome to committee, Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Great to be here.
And I believe before you get started, you have a DE amendment. Would you like to start with that before we get into your bill?
I do. Would someone here move that for me, the DE one?
I will move the DE1 amendment to House File 2140. To the amendment, Representative Kraft.
So this gets the bill in the form that I would like it, and I think maybe what we should do is go to testifiers, and then I can kind of summarize at the end if that works.
So, okay, so we'll approve the amendment here and then get to your testifiers?
I would like to do that, yes, please.
Any discussion of the DE1 amendment? All those in favor into adopting the DE1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted. To House File 2140 as amended, Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this is the More Homes, Right Places bill. And it really, I'm carrying this bill and feel so passionately about it and other housing bills you're hearing really because of a number of things. One, it started my time on City Council and learning how important housing and affordable housing issues is to my community. And then also through the process of door knocking, I can't tell you how many times I heard the comment, well, I've lived in this community for 30 years, for 40 years, but I couldn't afford my house today. Or my kids can't afford to live near here. Or I work in your community and I can't afford to live anywhere near here. You know, on top of that, many of you may know that I got involved with politics to do something about climate change. So I've realized that, you know, we have this massive housing shortage in Minnesota and really across the country. And where we choose from here to put that housing is really important. If we allow it to sprawl and pave over more farmland, pave over more green space, it will also make our transportation emissions problem a lot worse. Now, even if that's not something that motivates you, let me talk about the other things that it makes worse. If we allow that to happen, we are placing a time tax on people, requiring more time of them to be in their car, in congestion, less time with their families, less time in community.
Recording in progress.
All right. And we're increasingly making that happen to the folks that are at least able, at least fortunate among us. So I'm really excited about this bill. This bill is really focused at the place in between single family homes and small apartment buildings. And with that, maybe I'll turn it over to testifiers and then at a later, after that, go more into the specifics of the bill.
Thank you, Representative Kraft. We'll get into testifiers. I do want to note today we have a lot of testifiers for this bill and the next bill, so we're going to try to keep them to 2 minutes a testifier just so we can give everyone appropriate time to get through the bills we have on the agenda today. So first person we have off the test file will be Cecil Smith. And if he's not here yet, we'll move to Brian Baer. Welcome to committee. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you. My name is Brian Baer. I'm the city administrator for the city of Hugo. I'm testifying today on behalf of the League of Minnesota Cities and Metro Cities. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. I'd like to thank the author of this bill for listening to comments so far. However, we do still have some concerns. The bill as amended by the DE1 would create mixed housing districts on 50% of the land in our non-urban city, that is the city of Hugo, is zoned residential. But in Hugo, roughly three quarters of our city is in the urban reserve, which makes meeting this requirement difficult, if not impossible. Our city is also prohibited from drilling new wells to access drinking water because of the White Bear Lake problem. Mandating extra high densities in areas of the city where we haven't planned for it is extraordinarily problematic for us. Okay? Let's talk about municipal state aid streets. Might not be what you think. In Hugo, they wind through neighborhoods and rural areas. They are in no way considered commercial corridors by anyone. We cannot find any logic to creating higher density along these corridors. Even if we thought we could add new density to our city, we would not locate the density along these corridors. State aid streets must be designed to meet state aid standards, and the state requires the streets in Hugo to be posted as no parking for safety reasons. Choosing these specific streets as corridors for new housing units where parking rules would be eliminated is additionally problematic. Further, the sewer pipes under our state aid streets are not designed with extra capacity for extra living units. Homeowners associations. These are proposed by developers as a way to be creative with development to build smaller units and higher densities. The HOA provides the maintenance of private streets and common spaces, and it's the city's responsibility to ensure a developer fulfills their promises and actually creates the HOA. A condition of approval is the way that this happens. We condition it. Preempting that condition may preempt HOAs altogether and eliminate a good development option. This bill interferes with a fundamental city authority, zoning and land use, which impacts the ability of cities to plan and respond to local conditions. It dismantles the comprehensive planning and zoning processes that we've worked to build our communities. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for your time today. We look forward to continuing to work with you on these issues.
Thank you, Mr. Baer. Next on the list will be Scarlett Bennett. And I believe they are online. Go ahead and introduce yourself for the record and welcome to committee.
Thank you. I am very happy to be here. My name is Scarlett Bennett, and I am the Director of Housing Development for Kraska Community Action, which is located in Grand Rapids, Minnesota, and also has an office in International Falls, Minnesota. And I am here today to testify in support of Housing File 2018. So Chair Igoe and representatives, it is a pleasure to be here. The region to which I serve and advocate for today in support of this bill encompasses 13,000 square miles of our state. This includes nearly 30 cities and townships and 15 school districts. Itasca County and Couchiching County alone encompass 6,082 square miles, which is nearly half of that area. And taking this into consideration, that this means that there are nearly 30 city councils with 30 planning and zoning committees with different zoning districts and maps, setback and density requirements, different permitting processes and fees and approvals, and different definitions. Some of our cities and communities have future land use maps, while others do not, and some have updated their zonings, while others are in the need to help understand the impacts of their own zoning rules when it comes to entertaining a potential future development and how to attract a developer. It's not uncommon for a lot of our cities to not have had an update to their land use ordinance or zoning ordinance in over 30 years. A lot of us developers like myself who work in the affordable housing realm don't have time to do this, and they don't want to work in this type of environment. And cities and councils can flat out refuse to have conversations regarding development needs and regarding the changes in zoning and the needs for conditional use permits. In our region, as Representative Igoe very well knows, a lot of our communities are landlocked, and when land is available, the barriers are often challenging. So zoning and permitting for the benefit of a city's residents and economic health and well-being should not be one of them. Neither should a lack of resources be a barrier to help cities gain deployment in which they need. So cities sometimes lack the resources, and we have communities that are, you know, resisting change out of fear, misinformation, and common NIMBYism. So when we look at rural areas, we need to make housing make sense. And I believe that the Housing File 2018 is a great baseline, and it's a great start. And if we're really going to start tackling this problem, housing has to work for people and the people that are behind it and willing to make it happen and not politics. Housing is not, it's a basic need and it's a critical driver of a study's. I apologize, I've been working from home today with kids. Sorry, this is Minnesota. But I understand that we have a housing crisis that's very real in Minnesota, and it applies to constituents that are both Republican and Democrat. And with the big barriers that we face, like cost, capital, control, and compliance, zoning should be one that we don't have to worry about. And again, to reiterate, I testify in support because I feel that even though a lot of our cities have moved mountains to gain development, a lot of them will not. And I think that this bill will be a great step forward as a baseline, a guide point, and a reference to help cities build that capacity that they need to entertain future development. So thank you, and sorry for the interruption.
No worries. Thank you, Ms. Bennett. It looks like Cecil Smith is here if you want to take the stand. Welcome to committee, and please introduce yourself for the record.
This is 2140.
Mr. Chair, I think I'm here for the commercial, multifamily and commercial.
Oh, looks like our agenda might be a little haphazard here then, so I apologize.
Thank you.
Give us 1 second, make sure we got your right testifiers here, Representative Kraft.
Mr. Chair, if it'd be helpful, there's some other stuff I could go through that I was going to wait to the end. I could do that for a little bit.
If that's okay, why don't you go to that, Representative Kraft. I want to make sure you get your right testifiers here. Yeah. Okay. Apologies.
No, no problem. So, you know, there's no one thing that is going to magically resolve our affordable housing crisis. But it cannot be resolved without fixing housing supply. And I've seen a lot of data, and I think when you look at the data, it screams out at you that we have a supply problem. And so I want to go through a little bit of that just to level set. And there's a handout that I gave that starts with yes to homes. And I'm going to peel out a few slides there. So if you go to the slide 3, this shows that our affordable housing gap, that households that don't have access to affordable housing at the lower end of our affordability scale, 114,000 gap, okay? That's on that affordable side. If you go to slide 5, this is evaluating the decade from 2011 to 2020, the goals that we had in the 7 county metro area for affordable housing. And what you can see is, based on the goal, we hit 44% of that goal. So the message here is that our current approaches are not working. If you look to slide 6, I think this really is where you can see really clearly the housing gap. You can see us going along at the fairly consistent 30 to 40,000 starts per year, and then it just dropping off a cliff after the 2008 Great Recession, and it just starting to get back up. That's where that gap is coming from. Slide 7 is another thing to show that the deficit isn't getting better, right? So this is from the U.S. Census. It looks at the deficit we have in 2018 versus 2023, and you can see that deficit is growing up to about almost 100,000. Then I want to turn to slide 8. This one is pretty stark, and I think yours is not in color, but what it shows is, if you see in the 2008 to 2013 timeframe, you see that the chart that's kind of high and then drops off, that's the number of $200,000 and below homes on the market. And the one at the bottom, if you look down at the bottom, the dark line that is going up and now is the most number of homes we have on the market, that's $500,000 and above. So this chart just shows you the impact of that housing supply problem on the prices that have to be paid on housing. And then a little bit more on that, if you look at slide 9, you look at the percent growth in home prices versus median household income just from 2016 to 2023. If we back this up even more, it would be worse, going from a 30% increase in household income, the median home prices increased 71%. Slide 10, I call this the glimmer of hope. All right, this is stuff that has been done by Minneapolis. They enacted policies to increase housing supply. And here is where you can see that their change in housing units overall in Minnesota and Minneapolis was much higher. They're the bar on the left. The change in average rent is much lower, 1% versus 14% across Minnesota. And, by the way, the change in homelessness dropped down. These policies we're talking about, are the data is screaming at us to do them and can be successful. So that's the level set that I want to do. And then if we're ready for testifiers, I can then after go into the specifics of the bill.
Yes, it looks like we got it figured out. We had one or two get switched around when it printed, so then it flip-flopped everything, but I think I got the order back in front of us. So next on the list then would be Rick Varco. Welcome to committee. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Chair Igo and members of the committee, my name is Rick Varco. I am the political director of SEIU Healthcare Minnesota and Iowa. Our union represents over 50,000 healthcare workers in hospitals, clinics, nursing homes, and self-directed home care. What good is a union pay raise if your landlord just jacks up the rent? Too many of our members pay too much for housing. The main culprit is local municipal governments who won't let them pay someone to build the housing they can afford. We are short 100,000 homes. The scarcity drives up prices most for service workers like our members. When cities limit housing, the people don't disappear. Last year, testifying on a similar bill, an SEIU member described how she spent a year and a half living mostly in her Jeep with five kids. She would park overnight in various locations, then her kids would try to go to school, and she would go to work. This bill would make it legal to build more housing that service workers can afford. In most cities, most of the land is currently reserved for single-family homes. Only a fraction of the land is available for triplexes and other more affordable types of housing. Lots of people like big houses and a big yard. But when you are struggling, you want a roof and some walls. It should be legal to build more places like that. Current law gives exclusive control over how much new housing will be built to local residents. Political decisions should give voice to all those affected. New housing anywhere lowers costs for the entire region. But current residents who benefit most from excluding new residents are given sole control. You can't expect this system to ever produce anything other than the most minimal increase in housing supply. This bill simply allows the rest of us, through the state, which is our democratic voice, to speak up in favor of a few minimal steps to build the housing we need. This is a pro-worker issue. That is why the Minnesota AFL-CIO passed a convention resolution in support of relaxing local restrictions on housing supply. Finally, whether you think Minnesota needs lower taxes or better public services, the budget reality this session is that you won't be able to do much of either. But this bill does not cost anything. At no cost, you can lower the number one expense for almost every family, and the impact will only grow over time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Varco. Next on the list will be Charles Gardner, who I believe is online. Please introduce yourself for the record and continue with your testimony.
Hi, Chair Igo and members of the committee. Thank you for allowing me to offer informational testimony on HF 2140. I am Charles Gardner. I'm a research fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. I study housing policy and affordability across the country. And as part of my research, I've recommended reforms to local land use regulations similar to those that are proposed in this bill, as crucial to reducing housing costs. And so as you know, cities and towns across Minnesota have many rules that limit the quantity and type of homes that can be built. This includes minimum lot size regulations, height limits, and single-family zoning. In part due to how these rules restrict the creation of new housing supply, many Minnesota residents are suffering from rising housing costs. Since the beginning of 2020, it's estimated that home prices have risen over 25% statewide, and the typical mortgage payment on the median-priced home has risen from about $1,600 a month to $2,750 a month in 2024. So restoring property owners' flexibility to build housing in different configurations and at higher densities is an essential step toward bringing rents and prices under control. Its importance is increasingly being recognized at the state level, and this is nationwide. In our work, we've cataloged how many other states have already enacted very similar reforms to the one that's being proposed here, including Arizona, Maryland, Montana, Vermont, and Washington. All those states have already enacted bills legalizing between 2 and 4 units on single-family lots in various areas, and many other states are considering them. We've included written testimony with links to our work. We can find these bills and read more about them if you're curious. Allowing more and denser housing to be built where currently only single-family homes are permitted is a market-driven approach to improving affordability. So this bill would help reduce the cost of newly constructed homes by allowing home builders essentially to at least triple the density on many lots, adding to supply. It also provides for a streamlined administrative approval process for housing. Streamlining procedure is another important area that is ripe for state reform. Just a comment on the balancing of interests. The benefits of new housing are dispersed. When new housing is built, it benefits the people who live in it, but also frees up some less expensive housing in other areas that residents of the new building are leaving behind. And this improves housing affordability overall, in the market overall. But despite these collective benefits, many residents resist the prospect of nearby housing construction and neighborhood change. State-level action can help reconcile these interests in a way that respects the rights and interests of all state residents. So ideas like those proposed in this bill would achieve this by setting reasonable limits on the local use of the zoning power and would allow the housing market to better respond to rising demand, which would improve affordability without requiring any government subsidies. The bill would also put Minnesota in the company of a growing list of states, which I mentioned, that have enacted legislation allowing more units per lot. Thank you. That's all I have.
Thank you, Mr. Gardner. Next on the list will be Peter Wagenius. Welcome, committee. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Peter Wagenius, Legislative Director of Sierra Club North Star Chapter. Excited to be able to testify on the same side as Mercatus. Minnesotans want homes near their jobs, transit, and amenities like grocery stores and parks. But current policies force maximal development to the fringe of the metro area, requiring people to drive the longest possible distances and destroying more forests, wetlands, farmland, and open space. Legalizing a variety of housing types in walkable communities would help us address housing affordability, preserve farmland, and protect our environment. Maximal sprawl, as noted, is not a product of the free market. Local city policies have made efficient and economic use of land illegal. In MnDOT's review of policies to reduce the growth of vehicle miles traveled, they ranked land use and parking policies as more impactful than every other option combined. This is a statewide problem, and the state must act to address this. It's just crazy to think 182 elected boards for 182 different cities and townships in the metro area could ever address this, let alone the number statewide. Cities currently have the power to block housing, and they've been using it year after year, decade after decade, but only because the state allows them to. I worked in city government for 16 years. Our city attorney set me straight on this question right away. He said, Peter, cities have no power under the U.S. Constitution, none. Cities only have the powers delegated to us by the state legislature. That's it. So the legislature could continue to let cities fail on housing, but the state could also say, we're done waiting for you. It's time to set minimum standards. If we let the cities keep failing at this point, we are complicit in their failure. The math is clear. Why are we so far behind in production of new housing units? There has been a simultaneous increase in population for the last six decades and a simultaneous decrease in the number of people per household. We have smaller families now. To have kept up, we would have needed to allow more housing units to accommodate both. It's not partisan. It's just math. Cities have reacted to the math by blocking housing. It's so bad that there are 11 cities in the metro area that have fewer people today than their previous peak populations in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s. The state must not ignore the math. It's time for action. And these two bills you're hearing today are a great place to start. And we're honored to support them as a part of the entire bipartisan land use reform package. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Wagenius. Next on the list will be Linnea Goderstad. Welcome to committee. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Hi, my name is Linnea Goderstad. I am a resident of District 59B and a volunteer for Neighbors for More Neighbors. I'm here today to testify in support of HF 2140. I moved to Northeast Minneapolis in 2014 and from the start loved my community there. My then fiance and I rented a one-bedroom apartment in a fourplex that couldn't be built in most Minnesota neighborhoods today. We loved our neighborhood and we wanted to stay, and we were able to afford a three-bedroom attached townhome that also couldn't be built in most Minnesota neighborhoods, three blocks from our apartment, where we now live with our seven-month-old and three-year-old. Attached homes like ours, along with triplexes and fourplexes that HF 2140 legalizes, are more accessible than single-family homes. The existence of a variety of types of homes, including our townhome complex and other similar buildings in our neighborhood, allow families to stay in the neighborhoods we want to live in. My mother and in-laws are of retirement age, and they need a single-story living and a home where they are not required to shovel or mow. And over the past decade, they moved into single-story condo units within a couple miles of our townhome. Again, the type of homes they live in also could not be built in most Minnesota neighborhoods today. But because of the different types of homes that were allowed in my neighborhood, my children are growing up seeing their grandparents once a week. And my whole family has the enormous additional support of having extended family nearby. Allowing different styles of homes allows our multi-generational extended family to live near each other, and that's not the only thing that it does. Homes in my neighborhood and across the state are not affordable, and they are getting more and more expensive because there are not enough of them. This includes rent and mortgage prices. This bill will allow more homes in the neighborhoods we already have in our state, which will help take the pressure off the cost of housing across the board. It will also allow the new homes that are built to be more affordable because they'll be able to share more infrastructure costs the way my home does. This bill will also allow different styles of homes in our Minnesota neighborhoods, which I can attest to from my family's experience is a huge benefit for all of us. And for these reasons, I'm asking you to support HF 2140. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Goderstad. Next on the list will be Greg Krushke. I hope I got that right. Welcome to committee. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you. My name is Greg Krushke. I'm here on behalf of the City of Owatonna and the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities. In my role, I am the Community Development Manager for the City of Owatonna. One of our big accomplishments was last year, the City of Owatonna adopted their first ever comprehensive plan. And in going through that in a thorough public engagement process, we came up with ways to find ways to add density and walkable neighborhoods within our city that is, you know, was incorporated in 1862. So moving through that, we developed a number of nodes throughout our city of where these density areas could sprawl out from and be able to develop that going forward. With the proposed bill here, that addresses these in corridor styles and density areas, with the vast number of acres in Owatonna that we have, to get to a 50% level just doesn't work for us. But we can do this in other existing areas that we've developed in our comprehensive plan to be able to address some of the density and how we can continue to grow our city. We are in desperate need of housing in Owatonna. However, we cannot get developers to look at Owatonna to come down there. Whether they're building in Lakeville, whether they're building in Rochester, they're all close enough areas, but that house costs the same amount to build in Lakeville as it does in Rochester or in Owatonna. And you know, the lumber's all the same cost, the labor's the same cost, everybody's working everywhere. So to be able to attract people to come down and sell that house in Owatonna, it becomes an extremely difficult proposition. It's something we've struggled with for a number of years. I actually spent my morning this morning up at a real estate journal event trying to attract builders and developers to Owatonna to come and build housing to match our comprehensive plan that we have in place here that we recently adopted. So we do have some concerns with this bill. We don't want to throw out our comprehensive plan. This cost us $150,000. we've got a lot of pride in this, a lot of community effort and engagement in adopting this, and we don't want to have to go another direction to continue to try and to get our housing that we need for our community. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Krushke. Next will be Cap O'Rourke. Welcome to committee, and please introduce yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Cap O'Rourke. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Association of Small Cities. So I was presented with a fun little trivia fact yesterday in reading the DE1. How many cities under 5,000 are located within 1 mile of one of the cities that have a population of over 150,000? The answer is six. We have six small cities that would be considered and labeled urban municipalities within the Twin Cities. The average population of these small cities is 900. So our concerns are with how our small cities within this definition are going to meet the requirements of this. I'm not sure if this was the intended outcome of this amendment, but we have cities such as Hilltop and Landfall, Sunfish Lake, Lauderdale, Lilydale, that simply do not have some of the resources needed to have this higher density housing, even if they would want it. Two of these communities are essentially mobile home communities. So one of our concerns is that in crafting a targeted legislation to get more density, no pun intended, that it may have inadvertently caught up some of our smallest cities, and they are going to have a difficult time meeting these standards and adjusting. Even if they had wanted to add more density, some of these communities simply don't have the resources to do so. So as this bill continues and moves forward, we would look to try to find a way to help these cities and not impact them inadvertently.
Thank you, Mr. O'Rourke. That concludes everyone I have signed up to testify, but is there anyone from the public that wishes to testify? If so, please make your way to the front and then introduce yourself for the record.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and other committee members. I am Ron Williams from Robbinsdale and urge you all to vote for the passage of these two bills, HF 2140 and 2018. In Minnesota, we look out for each other. We want a home for ourselves and our families, but everyone deserves a reasonable housing. Reasonable means that it meets the needs of a person and the person's family. That means that it's affordable for them. It provides a home for them which they can go to work, and accessible to groceries and other stores. However, exclusionary zoning laws have helped to lead to a shortage of at least 100,000 homes in our state. House File 2140 would help turn the situation around by requiring the creation of mixed-use housing zones. This would reinforce state investment in communities by allowing more homes, up to four, near streets built with state infrastructure spending. This would encourage not only more abundant housing in this state, but cheaper and thus more affordable rental and owner housing in Minnesota. HF 2018 will allow multifamily homes to be built in commercial areas to help build busy, bustling neighborhoods with coffee shops, restaurants, and corner stores. But of the mixed uses this creates, more people will be able to live closer to work and the grocery store. These bills stand up for the secure, abundant homes for all Minnesotans. We envision a future where we all find homes and we love in neighborhoods we choose. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Williams. Anyone else from the public that wishes to testify? So I know we had one question for one of the testifiers. We want to do that quick, and then Representative Kraft will go back to you. So I think the one question was from Representative Johnson.
Actually, I do have a question from the testifier, but I also have questions general for when we get to the House members. But one of the questions was for the gentleman that was here with the Sierra Club. You had stated that cities, you have, I don't know how many cities you listed that were decreasing in population. Could you list what those cities are or what counties those are in?
Yep. Mr. Wagenius, yeah, please. Thank you.
The cities in question that are underneath their peak populations are the city of Minneapolis, the city of St. Paul, and nine other cities directly adjacent to them. And if you give me a moment, I can share them with you. I would note that there are many other cities in the metro area just barely above their peak populations. The cities that are below include Minneapolis, St. Paul, Richfield, Golden Valley, Columbia Heights, Fridley, Brooklyn Center, New Hope, Crystal, Robbinsdale, Golden Valley. I think I may have listed one, and South St. Paul.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Chair. That's what I wanted to hear, and because I've seen those reports too, and where they're escaping to is what we're trying to change to make them those cities. So thank you.
Next on the list will be Lee Howard.
Yes. Thank you. I had a question for Mr. Krushke from Owatonna. If he's still here.
Mr. Krushke, if you could come to the front, please.
Mr. Krushke, thanks. Thank you for testifying, and thank you for your work in Owatonna to build the comprehensive plan that you mentioned. And you talked about how in your comprehensive plan you did identify nodes for additional density where you thought that made the most sense for your community. And that, you know, as I understand in this bill, that is sort of the direction. We want to make it so that cities have the choice about where, and we have this 50% figure, and you said that didn't work. I'm just curious, in terms of your city, and don't need an exact number, but do you have a sense of what percent of your area zoned for single family in your comprehensive plan you're looking for additional density?
Mr. Krushke.
Yeah, I would say it's tough because if you look at a certain number of acreage, you know, we have parks that are zoned single family residential. We have a municipal golf course that's zoned single family residential. So it depends on how you really look at that number to be able to come up with an acreage 50%. But, you know, at the end of the day, we wouldn't be approaching 50% just because of the vast number of acreage that is there. We'd be talking, I mean, the city of Owatonna as a whole is 16 square miles. It's probably somewhere between, I would say, 6 to 8 square miles. You know, not in acres, but rough numbers as we go. But it's, you know, a lot of the eastern portion, and obviously there's higher density areas along, you know, the more commercial corridors and the more commercial areas that we have. Just taking a rough number off of that. But, you know, when we look at the proposal with the state aids, you know, the state aid streets and how that, you know, how that number of streets come in, and, you know, obviously I've got a graphic here that nobody can see, but, you know, those streets don't necessarily align with where we would want the density to go. You know, and so to be able to build that into a node area instead of a linear corridor, and to be able to build that into a node makes a lot more sense, as you can have a center point and you can build the infrastructure out from that point and be able to service that area instead of a long strip that might not work. You might need lift stations, you know, pedestrian corridors, other things, you know, make that much more difficult. So with how we've done this, you know, we obviously a lot of public engagement to be able to get to this point, and that's really where the node concept came from.
Lee Howard.
Thank you, Mr. Krushke. That's really helpful, and I think that the comments help us as we seek to craft this bill. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Great. And I believe Representative Scraba then had a question as well for it. Nope. Okay. Guess he didn't. All right, so then Representative Kraft, we'll go back to you for comments before we go to member questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted just to hear the comments and walk through the bill a little bit and point to some spaces within the bill that address some of the things that were raised. But I think it's really important to recognize that this bill was the product of a lot of interaction, a lot of talking with advocates, with city groups. One of the biggest pieces of feedback that we did hear was to have more flexibility, to go towards more performance-based approach. And that's what's within here. We can talk about things at the margins and things like that, but that's where this is going. So to walk through it, subdivision one is about definitions. Subdivision two is where you first start seeing city choice. So conceptually here, cities select a portion of their residentially zoned districts to legalize more housing types. We do provide some guidance that we would like to see these selections done by considering proximity to transit, to commercial areas, to public amenities, to put density in the right places. Then we break it up by different types of cities. So for cities of the first class, there's a couple of options. One is that 75% of their, at least 75% of their district's zone residential should support up to quadplexes. They have another option, though, that if they want to go a different approach, they could go to an average density of one unit per 1,500 square feet. And we do ask for density along main thoroughfares. We're using MSA streets. And what you'll notice is this is a relatively new concept in the bill right now. We haven't put in the number, the density per acre we're looking for, because this is a new concept that we've brought over the past week or so, and so we want to interact more with cities here. But the conceptually here is pick where in those corridors you want to put more density, and there'll be a higher requirement for larger cities. Then when you go to the adjacent, to Minneapolis, to cities over 150,000 in population, the requirement changes, still 75% of residentially zoned districts that need to support up to triplexes. The other option is still there to do an average density of one unit per 1,500 square feet, and still asking for density along those main thoroughfares. For non-urban cities, which is other cities in the any other city in the seven county metro, and cities with a population of 10,000 or more outside of the metro, the would ask for 50% of their districts, residentially zoned districts, to support up to triplexes. The other option is to do it more wherever you want, an average density of one unit per 4,000 square feet. A note, cities outside of the seven county metro area, less than 10K in population, are exempt. Also to make sure to understand is that nothing in the above section mandates any amount of new housing to be built. It simply ensures that it is an allowable use alongside existing uses. Also within this subdivision is a key point, and this is something that I think would address most, if not all, of the issues raised by the testifier from Hugo. Additional housing cannot be forced on an area where the infrastructure cannot support it. For example, this bill would not apply for areas that have well and septic. Additional restrictions that are built into this is additional housing cannot be forced on an area that would impact floodplains, areas of critical or historical concern, wild and scenic rivers, et cetera, et cetera. So we tried to have the let's not put housing in dumb places, what I would say, okay? Moving to subdivision three, I want to point out here bulk standards. So this is an area where last year there was a lot of concern of getting into specific size of setbacks and the like. What we've gone to here is to say, look, if we're going to legalize triplexes, you can't come in some other way and put some other controls on them that make them impossible to build. So what we're saying is here, look, you can do whatever bulk controls you want, but at the end of the day, there has to be 1,500, you have to be able to allow 1,500 square feet per residential unit. So duplex would mean your combination of controls need to allow for a 3,000 square foot building. Triplex, it needs to allow for a 4,500 square foot building. So flexibility, but you can't prevent what we're asking for in another way. Their subdivision three has, this is where we have the aesthetic mandate language, the parking language, and HOA language. And that right now has mirrored the standalone bills. And so we know that there, as discussions happen there, I would imagine we'd reflect those in this bill. Moving to subdivision four, this is a key area where we talk about approvals. One of the biggest issues you hear that drive up costs from developers is unpredictability. that you start a process and you never know how long it's going to end, how long it's going to take. And so what we're saying is here is for up to quadplexes, we should be able to approve them in the same way that you approve a single family home. Use your existing process, don't create a new process, but we should be able to approve it in the same way. I think that's pretty reasonable. For things larger than that, they need to use an existing well-defined process, something referred to as 1599, which if you ask me details on that, I will need to pull up someone else to answer that, but it's a well-understood process. And then subdivision 5 is about you can't, you know, have any funny business to modify this somewhere else to make it moot. And subdivision 6 or what happens if you don't do this, what is the result? Lastly, the last bit is we've put forth a staggered approach to implementation so that larger cities implement first, followed by medium size and then smaller cities later. And that's to, if there's resources being used to help folks implement this stuff that they, not everyone is going to them at once. So that is the bill. And I appreciated the comment from Mr. O'Rourke. And we don't want a patchwork of stuff happening, patchwork of different kind of things, but you raised some good points and we're happy to talk further about it.
Thank you, Representative Kraft. Now we'll move into member questions. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Chair Igo. Thank you, Representative. I do have a number of questions that came up. One of them, I'm going to start off right off, is that Subdivision 5, which was brought up to authors after a meeting yesterday, after a question that I asked, which said, would this prevent cities from requiring dedications of parks, which is required right now in Cottage Grove for any new development going in. The effort is to keep communities together, to get the kids out of the houses and playing and keep green spaces. I see that subdivision, and when the DE was done and rewritten, that subdivision is still in there preventing dedication of parks. I was told that the law was not intended or the bill was not intended to do that, but I still see that word still being utilized. So my question again here, does that eliminate cities from requiring developers and new communities, the cities requiring parks or money in lieu of a park to be able to put a park somewhere else?
Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I wasn't here yesterday, and so maybe I'll ask for if there was some discussion yesterday to, it seems like it's building on things from yesterday, so I'd rather hear about that before responding.
Lead Howard.
Thank you, Chair Igo. Representative Johnson, we had a conversation about this afterwards and had some subsequent conversations. The intent here is to make sure that we're not creating backdoor ways for cities to create additional new ways to create additional fees, not to supersede what is currently the state of play. We had a conversation offline with League of Minnesota Cities about seeing if we should look at a language tweak, but that is the intent of the legislation.
If I could add to taking some chair privilege, the last sentence really kind of gets into a quote, more restrictive than those in section or other municipal law or rule. So it there's discussions being had, but that last sentence is kind of the sentence that cleans up the concern as understood by authors who are carrying multiple parts of this in their bills. So Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I would just, maybe I can do this in future amendments, just take that word out and then it removes any possibility, because that's what it's called when you're at the city level, because I've been on Planning Commission and on City Council. It's a dedication. It's a park dedication that is required when you put in a community, when you put in these developments. And otherwise, you just end up creating, you take away all the green spaces and you just create inner city areas. And that's not what we want to do. So if that would be my suggestion in the future. The other question, sorry, Chair, I have questions. There was a comment made that there was no cost to this, which I have a little bit confused, because we had the city of Owatonna, I believe, up here said they just spent $150,000 in their comp plan. And my understanding is understanding is that was this would require every city to create a new comp plan, which then would cost hundreds of thousands of dollars to do. So my question is, why isn't there a fiscal note in here or acknowledgement of that, or is there going to be some compensation to these cities of in the tune of millions of dollars to compensate that it's not a mandate, unfunded mandate put down on our cities now?
Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Johnson. So I will maybe comment a little bit on what the testifier said. I think he was talking about relative to our general fund. Look, there's no free lunch on stuff, right? Things require work. This does not require a new comprehensive plan, so that is false. And as cities right now are going through a process of updating their comprehensive plans and update their zoning codes, fairly regularly, yes, this asks them to build that into their update process, and we give them time to do it.
Representative Johnson.
I would, Mr. Chair, sorry. I would turn to cities on that because a lot of cities have just finished their comp plans, and you know it's a 2030 plan, 2040 plan, 2050 plan, and that's usually a 10-year plan. And if it requires, if you're changing the density in a community, you have to update that and get that approval from the Met Council. So I would just say that there would be a lot of cost and time associated with that. But question I have, another plan I have is, what about, I know you talked about it would not be required or did not limit or would not people have infrastructure issues or challenges. Mm-hmm. What about our communities that are dealing with PFAS and the thought and being restricted from the DNR from putting in wells and the places that can put it in require treatment centers. I'm talking about Lake Elmo as an example. Being told they have to put in a bunch of multi-family when their system and their city can't handle it just because the DNR shut them down as far as being able to build wells in the homes that they are building, there's challenged right now. So would there be a thing that if cities are challenged with PFAS and limitation in water, would they be excluded at this time?
Representative Kraft.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson. So I'm not familiar. I mean, I'm obviously familiar with the horrific PFAS situation we have, but are these places, are they not allowing single family homes today?
Representative Johnson.
Yes, they are allowing single family homes, but I agree townhome development. Sorry, Mr. Chair, if I forgot it. Townhome development, multifamily homes add a lot more demand on water than a single family home. So I think you could build the number of single-family homes compared to how many multi-family homes in a community that will be. An example, Mr. Chair, bring in Lake Elmo as example. They have a mobile home park that has PFAS in the well. They are not allowed to hook up to the city water of Lake Elmo because of the water restrictions that have been put on them because they can't drill the wells. So that is their situation. So then to turn around and say they have to put in hundreds or more of these prop homes when they can't even take care of the communities that are actually there already would be a concern. And I'm just wondering if that would be something that they could exempt from.
So Representative Kraft, and I'll just add too, again, this bill in front of us isn't mandating the homes be built. Yet, if a developer wants to come and build those homes and work with the DNR to make those homes happen, that's what this bill would be doing. Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, I'll also point you to lines, especially 330 to 332, which is language that we've actually worked on with the cities that talks about issues, and it especially the last two, including the adequacy of existing public infrastructure imposed by a municipality to promote public health, safety, and general welfare. So I'm not an expert on this specific situation, but if adding housing is against the public health and general welfare, then this would allow to not be allowed. And I would say, you know, if they can build three single family homes, they can build a triplex. Thanks.
And Representative Johnson, I know we have to get a few more done, and out of respect for our next bill up by a fellow committee member, I think we're going to move on unless you have another short question, but very short.
No, I was just going to say thank you, Chair.
All right, other members for discussion. Lead Howard.
I'll be brief. Thank you, Representative Kraft, for all of your work on this bill and the body of our work to build more homes. I really appreciate the approach we're moving in this bill towards that performance standard method where we're sort of saying, cities, you know your cities well. We are having an expectation with a statewide housing shortage that we need to be building more homes in the right places, but we're going to let you all do the work to make sure it's going where it makes the most sense. To me, that's, again, an approach that we're listening through this process and adapting the bill, and I think ultimately gets us to a better final product. And just to reiterate what we heard from some of the other testimonies, these concepts are not brand new. They're working all across the country to build more homes, and that's having the impact of improving affordability and opening up all kinds of home opportunities, not just for those new homes, but the people that are moving in right behind if somebody's moving out of an existing home. And so this is exactly the direction we need to go, and I appreciate all your work on the bill.
And I'll just make a few closing comments as well. Thank you, Representative Kraft, for all the work you've done on this. I mean, being in a lot of these meetings with you over the last couple months and the compromise, I mean, even getting the DE in front of us today shows the collaboration that has occurred on this piece of legislation. And like my colleague Lee Howard said, this is something that is working nationwide, and we're seeing red and blue states enacting this. I'm pretty sure I just saw our vice president talking about how we need to do more stuff like this the other day. So it goes to show that this isn't a red or a blue issue, but an issue that's going to lift up all Minnesotans. With that, Representative Kraft, any closing comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. The other thing that data shows is that no individual city can solve this on their own. They can do great things, and if we don't do this statewide, they will fail. And so I'm really excited about where we've come to on this bill. I look forward to tweaking as necessary, but I'm excited for what comes next. And hopefully this is a foundation to partner with cities and creative approaches and really doing the stuff that we all know is necessary. So thank you all, and I urge your support.
With that, I re-renew my motion that House File 2140, be referred to the Elections and Finance and Government Operations Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? The motion prevails, and the bill is on its way. Thank you, Representative Kraft.
Thank you.
Next bill on our agenda today will be House File 2018. Representative Kozlowski, I'll let you get up there, and I'm assuming you want to move your bill.
Here I go, members. Yes, I would like to move House File 2018.
Representative Kozlowski moves House File 2018 to be referred to the Elections, Finance, and Government Operations Committee. Representative Kozlowski, to your bill, and I believe you have an amendment. Would you like to move that first to get us the bill in the shape you would like?
Yes, thank you, Chair. And I would like to move the DE to get the bill in the form and shape and where we're wanting to head.
Representative Kozlowski moves the A3 amendment to the amendment. Representative Kozlowski.
Great. Thank you, Chair and members. And in starting for today and before this bill of House File 2018, I also just want to start by acknowledging that it's Homeless Day on the Hill. Interestingly enough, last year when we presented the bill, it was on the exact same day. And so I think it's very fitting that we are room filled with advocates and Minnesotans. 72% of Minnesotans who have been clamoring and raising their voices and coming to the Capitol and border to border to say that we need more housing across all income levels. We know that homelessness is a housing problem. It's not an individual failure. It's actually a failure of our systems that have failed people, including workers across the state. For me, after the 2023 session, I was a part of the housing team that toured, as well as bonding with Representative Scraba. We went to over 50 cities, border to border, and we heard community after community that's saying that they are trying to grow. They want more housing, that we have a housing problem and not just a jobs problem. Apartments, townhomes, condos for workers, We heard from public employees who are driving 2 and 3 hours to get to their workplace. We have employees who we heard are living in cars and in hotels in main streets that are dying and fizzling out because there's nowhere for folks to live and there's nowhere for folks to then go and light up activity and generate our main streets. So to the bill and to this amendment, I just want to say that this is really a win-win in making a dent in that 114,000 unit gap that we talked about, especially for workforce housing, as well as the deep gap that we have for 30% in AMI and lower. HF 2018 is a piece of the larger package of this bipartisan bill and the Yes to Homes Coalition. And it is really purposeful in revitalizing our main streets and building more multifamily housing, condos, apartments, co-ops where it makes sense. It does this by legalizing apartments and condos along commercial corridors. And since last year, we've heard the bipartisan group, our many folks who have been working on these bills, city planners, coalition partners, city leaders, county leaders, your fingerprints are all over them. We heard in loud and clear that we need flexibility. We need to meet the unique needs, infrastructure, while also creating lines on the field and goalposts that don't move. And so in this DE and in this version of the bill that we're bringing forward is reflected those conversations. And I hope and look forward to the legislative process where we'll continue that log roll. I want to highlight just a few changes that have been made in the amendments, including deleting sections 1 and 2 entirely from the bill. Lines 318 through 321, this amendment is excluding affordable housing development from the mixed-use requirement in allowing cities, which we heard loud and clear, that the flexibility to ensure the preservation of commercial space and allowing market rate to require mixed use on the ground floor. Adding these additional layers in requirements for affordable projects who are not business leaders and aren't spurring this type of activity in their day-to-day to jump through these hoops discourages development of affordable projects. In lines 413 to 416, you will also see the removal of the aesthetics mandate and energy requirements. We're taking this out, and I want to be really clear that in taking this out, it's not meant as an invitation to cities to impose costly mandates that negate this bill. You can require front-facing doors and windows. I've talked to many cities who want to make sure that we are activating main streets, that we are transforming our downtowns, and that means no dead zones. And so these types of things help ultimately achieve that goal. And just want to highlight again why this was in the original bill is that we've seen project after project, especially affordable, go and die the death of 1,000 paper cuts with adding balconies and other costly aesthetics that ultimately lower the amount of units that we can build and really stifle the creation of affordable housing. Next, we roll to the clarification on the affordable bonuses. The density bonuses give developers slightly larger building margins, so that means more floor space or more units in exchange for including a certain number of affordable or now newly included workforce units in their development. This is a really a win-win approach that benefits cities and people who get a larger return on their investment in the community, which gains much-needed affordable housing units. Increasing the number of units increases tax capacity on each parcel, and more people means more folks who are spending money in our communities and staying local, and it's good for more housing choice. On this one, I want to give a special nod and appreciation to our friends on this side of the aisle, especially Rep. Dotseth, as we've been talking as Greater Minnesota members. We know that there's really unique needs that require very targeted approaches and collaboration to bring more projects out, especially to meet our workforce needs. And so the inclusion in the affordable bonus section for workforce housing, border to border, will make that a reality. That is it for the DE. So I'm going to go through a quick bill walkthrough, and then we'll turn it over to the testifiers.
Representative Kozlowski, would you like to get this amendment adopted quick, and then
yes,
you can?
Yes, that would be all great. Right. It's been a while since I've done a bill hearing since last year.
Perfect. any discussion of the DE amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted. Representative Kozlowski, to your bill as amended.
Great. Thank you, Chair Igo and members. So now that we've removed sections 1 and 2, we are off in the definition section. As a reminder, this bill from last year that subdivision 2 outlines really the where, and this is the where we'll be opening up zoning to allow residential multifamily developments, both market rate and affordable, in areas throughout a city that are zoned for commercial use. I want to be very clear that that's not in zones for residential. This section also addresses the requirements of those multifamily developments to meet the performance standards, state building codes, existing public infrastructure, environmental codes, as well as to protect public health, safety, and general welfare. I want to emphasize that this is where a very small portion of all communities are, and we're talking about in commercial parcels. Subdivision 3 adds on to the where and how. This outlines some limitations and standards that will be required of cities in the first class, along with cities within the 7-county metro, to ensure that multifamily development projects cannot just be legal on paper, but that they can be built and made a reality and not caught up in red tape that adds on time and money to projects. Subdivision 4 builds on the how by implementing an administrative review process for multifamily projects that's similar to what's already in statute in 1599, with the goal of keeping project timelines moving at a reasonable pace. Really, we just want to make sure that there's not an open window of time frame where projects can hang out there for an indefinite amount of time. And Subdivision 5 creates the option of affordable housing and workforce housing density bonuses, which again will help incentivize builders to include affordable units in their projects. And that also means more units will get out to market. Subdivision 6 bans the common use practiced by cities of enforcing excessive and restrictive controls, such as performance conditions, standards, fees, things that add on time and expense onto projects and ultimately stop their development. I also just wanted to take the time before we get to the testimony to prevent some mischaracterization of this bill. This bill does not mandate the construction of multifamily homes, condos, or apartment buildings. It just expands them as a legally available option throughout the state. And the bill also does not shift taxes onto homeowners. It incentivizes mixed-use developments, which will have a portion tax at the commercial rate. Apartments, while subject to a lower tax rate, often generate more taxes than commercial. This incentive means rehabbing obsolete, vacant, and blighted properties and turning them into thriving businesses and apartments. So in summary, this bill is seeking to establish a clear process for approving projects and creating a statewide uniform minimum standard. It is not a fix for all, but it will surely open up a lot more multifamily housing, save costs, and make it possible to have affordable workforce housing in every corner. So to that, I'd like to turn it over to the testifiers and get rolling.
Thank you, Representative Kozlowski. First on the list then for testifiers will be Cecil Smith. Welcome to committee. Please introduce yourself for the record. And I called you up for the right bill this time.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, Representative Kozlowski, members of the committee, my name is Cecil Smith. I'm the president and CEO of the Minnesota Multi-Housing Association. We represent 2,300 members who serve over 600,000 renters who make their home in more than 320,000 rental homes provided by our members. I'm here to testify in support of House File 2018. In 2016, MHA developed messaging and a framework around housing policy. It was and remains produce, preserve, and protect. Produce more housing, preserve our existing housing, protect renters from predatory conduct. Many others have adopted a similar approach for a balanced but comprehensive effort to improve our housing in Minnesota. Sadly, that was nearly 9 years ago. It is 7 years since the Minnesota Housing Task Force made similar recommendations to the governor and legislature, a task force in which I served as MHA's representative. And we now need 100,000 more homes. Finally, today is a hopeful day because we have a meaningful policy change before us, a positive incremental step that will enable more housing to be produced in desirable and appropriate localities. Multifamily housing is an excellent housing choice throughout the arc of one's life. Multifamily is a preferred land use option in premium locations. It is more energy efficient than other housing, and it accelerates population density so that local economies can thrive and can support new community amenities. For these reasons and more, we recommend passage of House File 2018. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Next on the list will be Amanda White. I believe, online. Please introduce yourself for the record and continue with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the opportunity to testify before you today. My name is Amanda White, and I am Vice President for the Florida Apartment Association. My remarks today are really going to focus on how Florida's Live Local Act can serve as a case study for the meaningful role that state policymakers like you play in increasing housing opportunity. So Florida's housing supply challenges really came to a head during the pandemic. Attainable housing became a kitchen table issue. At the same time, this issue was simultaneously wreaking havoc on the Florida business community looking to attract talent, as well as the public sector with a growing demand for new teachers, police officers, and firefighters to support our state's rapid growth. In Florida, it can take an average of 3.5 years, even in the most favorable conditions, to bring an apartment community to fruition from the start of due diligence to the time of final inspection when residents can ultimately move into their new apartment home. Depending on the local government, Florida housing construction projects have to face not only existing zoning barriers, but a procedural maze with multiple public hearings that often delay or outright prevent new apartments from ever coming to market. Or, in other cases, if a project is allowed to move forward, local governments often require housing developers to meet additional expectations that drive up construction costs and ultimately restrict supply. In 2023, the Florida legislature passed the Live Local Act with strong bipartisan support. The goal of this effort was simple: to incentivize and streamline the development of both affordable and workforce housing so all Floridians could live local by having housing options for residents at every income level and every stage of life. I want to share a few key highlights of this legislation that have made a profound impact and relate directly to the legislation before you today. First, the Live Local Act's land use provisions require a local government to allow qualifying housing construction projects to be developed on land that is zoned for mixed use, commercial, or industrial without a zoning change. In order to be eligible for this incentive, the project must set aside 40% of the units as affordable for at least 30 years. It's worth noting affordable is defined as apartment homes that are set aside for residents at or below 120% of the area median income, and this is designed to address both affordable housing and workforce housing needs. In essence, as a result of the Live Local Act, these developments are administratively approved without a public hearing. This alone greatly reduces the construction timeline and ultimately reduces project costs, which directly impact rents. The Live Local Act also prohibits a local government from imposing overly restrictive density, height, and floor area ratio requirements that often serve as additional barriers to development. These land use and development protections were very powerful tools that incentivized market rate developers to include affordable or workforce housing units in traditional market rate developments. Our developers were highly motivated by these incentives because they address one of the most uncertain and one of the most risky aspects of housing development, which is zoning and local approval. It's not uncommon for housing developers to invest hundreds of thousands of dollars in building plans and other legal resources during the initial phase of development, only to have the rug pulled out from under them when residents oppose the project at a public hearing, despite the tremendous need for housing in the community. So overall, while streamlining zoning can seem like a minor policy change, it can have a profound impact. The Live Local Act was a truly historic move for Florida, and in surveying our developers and operators across the state, I can attest that the land use provisions have already made an impact. In fact, based on early estimates from the Florida Housing Coalition, over 100 new developments are leveraging the land use tools in the Live Local Act since its passage in 2023, and this translates to over 31,000 apartment homes at varying stages in the construction pipeline right here in Florida as a result of our legislation. So as I wrap up, I just want to say that we applaud the sponsors, the co-sponsors, the members of the committee for looking for meaningful ways to make housing more attainable. We hope our early success in Florida helps demonstrate the meaningful role you can play in reducing barriers in your state. Thank you once again for your time and attention, Mr. Chair and members of the committee.
Thank you, Ms. White. Next on the agenda will be Brian Baer. Welcome back to committee. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, members, thanks for having me back. Good afternoon. I'm Brian Baer. I'm the city administrator for the city of Hugo in northern Washington County. I'm testifying on behalf of the League of Minnesota Cities and Metro Cities. I'd like to thank the author of this bill again for listening to concerns, but we still have some concerns. This bill requires a city to permit multifamily residential development in any zoning district that authorizes commercial uses. As the local zoning authority, we have done this in select locations where it makes sense, near shops and restaurants and places where you'd think about it. But please realize that not all commercial areas are the same. We noticed the bill exempts heavy industrial areas. Thank you, that makes sense. But in Hugo, some existing commercial uses involve the operation of scrap yards, junk yards, heavy contractor operations, shooting ranges, gun clubs, loading of rail cars, operation of heavy equipment. I can go on. These are uses that generate quality of life impacts for nearby residents. Believe it or not, we get complaints. We'd like to avoid locating high-rise apartment complexes with minimal setbacks immediately adjacent to some of these uses for the same obvious quality of life reasons. We think city officials are best prepared to make decisions of this type based on parcel-specific conditions. This bill obliterates parking requirements. In the city of Hugo in the Northeast Metro, there are very few locations, if any, where zero parking would be appropriate. There is no transit here, and frankly, the market will not accept zero parking. Unfortunately, though, on occasion, a developer sometimes makes a mistake. They make a poor decision, and that decision isn't backed by the market. When their project gets built, if it fails, then the community's stuck with it. And we'd like to avoid that by maintaining responsible zoning authority. The bill allows high-rise apartments up to 110 feet in places we don't plan for. Not only is this way out of character in Hugo, but you can imagine our fire chief will be asking for a whole fleet of fire trucks and rescue equipment and training that we can't afford. Finally, we've carefully planned for small future commercial nodes to serve neighborhoods, to promote walking and reduce vehicle trips. This is the thing that provides the mix in the mixed-use development. Allowing these areas to now develop as residential is not what the city wants. There's appropriate land in other locations of the city to accommodate residential needs, but only where it has been planned for. Let me say this again. In the city of Hugo, we are prohibited from drilling new wells to access drinking water. The water supply issues in the East Metro are a real thing. Local decision-making on how this happens is going to be very important. Adding new residential uses in places that we haven't planned for is very problematic. Thank you, Chair, for the time. Appreciate it. Glad to work with the author some more.
Thank you, Mr. Baer. Next up will be Sarah Larson. And if I could please encourage the testifiers, we are starting to get close on time. I've been pretty flexible so far, but I don't want to have to start speeding this up too much. Welcome to committee. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Chair, committee. My name is Sarah Larson. I'm a principal at Landon Group. As affordable housing consultants, we have been involved in the development or rehab of nearly 7,000 affordable housing units throughout the state. But the hard truth, we don't usually acknowledge it, is that we've seen many, many units of housing that were economically viable, construction ready, consistent with the comp plan of the city, and never built. I'll give you one example. We have many. But in 2021, a developer proposed a market rate development, nearly 200 units, five stories, in a western suburb. It complied with the density called for in the comprehensive plan. At one of the many required public hearings, council members said things like, "I love this project. This is an infinitely better use of the land." No city residents attended that meeting. In 2022, because of changing market conditions, the developer opted to make this project 100% affordable, included units for homeless households. They went back to council and proposed buildings with the same height and density, same building, really, and as the market rate building. The city council said things like, "Why are you making this so tall? Why are you not building townhomes? This building feels very large." In 2023, we obtained federal tax credits and state funding to build the project. February, the developer went back to council. They had changed the design, cut the unit density in half, still complied with the comp plan, the bottom end of it. Council chambers were standing room only. Neighbors in opposition had crowdsourced to fund their efforts, their lawn sign campaign. The result, not a single council member said they were willing to support the development moving forward and wanted a delay of a year and a half for a small area plan. That didn't work with the federal funding. The developer has now returned $25 million in funding, including some of the state funding that this body allocated 2 years ago. This proposed legislation will not shut out the local governments. Local governments create comp plans which provide local input. This legislation will allow housing to be built in the places the city designated. It will allow affordable housing to be built everywhere because it's needed everywhere. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Larson. Next will be Ann Mavity. Welcome to committee. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you so much. Chair Igo and members of the committee, my name is Ann Mavity, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Housing Partnership. And I'm also the co-chair of the Yes to Homes Coalition. And the Yes to Homes Coalition has a lot of unexpected partners across the housing continuum, but also beyond that, including healthcare, food shelves, AARP, and many others. I'm also a former city council member serving three terms as a city council member and has served on the board of the League of Minnesota Cities. And I say all this because I understand the complexities that we're wrestling with of these various perspectives on this issue. But the bottom line of why we need this legislation is that our current local housing approval processes are failing us. And across Minnesota, they're not producing the housing that everyone agrees that we need. So despite these ambitious state and regional and city level housing goals, we're constantly falling short and we're nowhere near reaching the production that we need. So we're endlessly negotiating project by project, 30, 40, 50 units at a time. And meanwhile, Minnesota's businesses are struggling to find employees. Minnesota hardworking, low-wage workers are trying to find housing, families and seniors as well, and they're paying way too much. So this system we have is not working. This bill maintains the key components of the current local controls approval processes, but it streamlines when and how they're implemented so that it creates predictability in expectations and in timelines. To highlight just two key examples, as Representative Kozlowski mentioned, the cities are able to require mixed uses in commercial areas so that when multifamily is built, it has cohesion within those commercial spaces. And in fact, sometimes these housing developments are actually the driver behind spurring more development in these areas because it's bringing people and consumers and customers to these areas. Finally, I want to highlight affordability. While more housing overall absolutely will help control these rising costs of housing, our biggest gaps are where the market doesn't deliver, and that's affordability, especially for the low-wage workers, our vulnerable neighbors. And so this bill provides allowances for projects that offer these affordable apartments, including not requiring commercial on the first floor and then some modest density allowances. So status quo is simply not working. This bill represents thoughtful and meaningful input and improvements to the process, and I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Ms. Mavity. Next will be Nadea Young. Welcome to committee. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Chair and members of this committee. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to testify for the House File 2018. My name is Nadia Young. I am the program coordinator for Winona Area Kitchen Table, which is a housing advocacy program at Engage Winona. My personal experience with housing instability has profoundly impacted my life. It led me to mental health struggles, forced me to take on adult responsibilities at a young age to help care for my siblings, and cause separation from my parents. I lived in overcrowded homes where it was difficult to focus and study, eventually leading me to drop out of high school due to my housing situation. In Winona, we face severe shortage of housing that meets everyone's needs. I still find myself stressed out about finding housing, especially as a single mom trying to secure a 3-bedroom apartment. The options are limited, and housing is simply too expensive. I dream of being able to take my children to good schools, my future after completing my bachelor's, but these dreams feel out of reach because of high cost of living. So many people in our community work tirelessly, but still cannot afford stable housing. We have families paying more than half of their income for rent, individuals choosing between paying for housing or buying food, and children struggling in school, kids being taken away from their homes because they don't have a stable home. There are moms working multiple jobs just to make ends meet, leaving them unable to be present for their children. I want everyone today to just think about this problem. Is this truly living? Yes, housing is a national crisis and not just a Minnesota crisis. Well, we can take steps to improve the system. If we work together, we create vibrant communities and provide opportunities that will make a lasting impact. This is a victory that has the potential to change lives in many ways we never seen before. I'm a living testament from being a proud alumni from the St. Paul Jeremiah program and having people who were alongside me helping me. I went from subsidized housing to market rate rent, but I still have stressors the way the system are set up today. I want to think about my children's future, and I want to see them inherit something in this world without worrying about my children and their children. House File 2018 represent a crucial first step in creating housing options for everyone that fits everyone's needs. It introduced new zoning regulations that will help make better use of community land, foster unity, and support active community engagement. By doing so, we can build sustainable communities and provide stability for families and individuals. And thank you again for having me.
Thank you, Ms. Young. Next on the list will be Peter Wiggins. Did you want to speak? I had in my email you're supposed to speak on two. Otherwise, we definitely can keep moving.
My testimony applies to both bills. I'll save you some time.
Perfect. Thank you, Mr. Wiggins. Next will be Jason Hale, who I believe is remote. Please unmute yourself and introduce yourself for the record and continue with testimony.
Thank you, Chair Igo and committee members for this opportunity. You can hear me?
We can hear you.
Right. Thank you to Representative Klosowski for facilitating this. Again, my name is Jason Hale. I am the founder of North Shore Development Co. Recently, I served as the executive director of the Cook County HRA up in northern Minnesota. And I have had the privilege of working in local government on real estate and housing development for about 12 years. I'm here to support two specific elements of this proposed bill. First, the allowance of multifamily and commercial non-industrial areas. And secondly, encouraging greater density for workforce housing. As many of you know, development is cyclical. Often certain trends take time to reach greater Minnesota or more rural places for more urban cores. For example, 10 to 15 years ago, mixed-use developments were all the rage. We saw a resurgence of them across the country, and for good reasons. Since then, however, the world has fundamentally shifted. Commerce is increasingly done online. Remote work and other things have resulted in pretty much a glut of vacant office spaces. And many of our commercial storefronts and others have spoken to this. They host space available signs in their store windows. Despite this, communities across the state voice concerns about reducing their available commercial space and require businesses at street level in order to build housing in commercial districts, assuming they allow it there at all. In short, many of our commercial cores are already struggling, and requiring mixed use is often a project killer, honestly. If there is a blighted and vacant property in our community commercial district, why wouldn't we allow housing to fill it? Finally, there's one other trend that has taken time to migrate to greater Minnesota, And up here up north, we usually just have to wait a few years and then eventually it happens. We're a poor to market rate housing. Developers have almost or more or less saturated the metro, Twin City metro area and larger markets with workforce or at least market rate housing. But towns across the state are desperate for this. I'm sure you've heard this many times. They needed to secure workers and attract and retain talent. The Workforce Housing Development Grant Program, which we're very appreciative of, has been so popular because the economics are so challenged in many parts of our great state. The math is just bad and the projects don't pencil. One tool that can help the math is greater density. I've had this experience on a number of my own projects where height restrictions and density requirements really make it almost impossible and sometimes impossible. And density is a tool that doesn't require any additional state funding. This bill isn't perfect, frankly. Trying to craft something for, I think, 853 cities across 87,000 square miles is a pretty tall order. However, as you all know, we face a budget deficit in only a few years. We will have to embrace creative ways like this to help get our housing need that we need in this great state. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hale. Next will be Lucas Franco. Welcome to committee. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Good afternoon, Chair Igo and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Lucas Franco. I'm here on behalf of Leuna, Minnesota, and North Dakota. We represent more than 14,000 skilled construction workers who build and maintain Minnesota's infrastructure. I'm here today to express strong support for HF 2018. This bill is a necessary step toward making our permitting process more transparent, predictable, and efficient, ensuring that we can build the housing and infrastructure Minnesota urgently needs. We all recognize that Minnesota faces a serious housing shortage. Too many families, including many of our members, struggle to find affordable places to live. One of the challenges to new development is an outdated and often cumbersome permitting process. HF 2018 is part of a broader effort, building on work done last session and continuing this session, to streamline the rules that govern zoning and comprehensive planning for multifamily and mixed-use development. In general, the permitting challenges in housing development are problems that we see as an organization throughout the economy. It's too hard and too slow to build the infrastructure we need, whether that is energy, transit, or housing infrastructure. We've made progress reforming permitting processes, but we have a lot of work to do. We can ensure responsible development practices while creating a predictable and transparent process. HF 2018 strikes a good balance between easing development barriers and maintaining local control. It allows needed housing projects to move forward in commercial areas without unnecessary bureaucratic delays, while at the same time maintaining important local standards, including protections for public health and safety. We're particularly encouraged by the affordable housing density bonus component, as we know how difficult it can be to permit and finance needed affordable units. With HF 2018, we're saying yes to an efficient system that gets housing built the right way, without delay, without unnecessary costs, and without sacrificing quality. I urge you to support and pass HF 2018. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you, Mr. Franco. Next will be Evan Vogel, who is remote, so please unmute yourself and introduce yourself for the record. If you're still with
us. Thank you, Chair Igo and members. Can you hear me?
We can hear you.
Perfect. Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair and committee members. My name is Evan Vogel. I'm the city administrator for the City of Cambridge, as well as a board member for the League of Minnesota Cities Board of Directors. I appreciate the opportunity to testify both yesterday and today as we discuss very important issues related to housing, zoning, and land use. There are several areas of this proposed legislation that are concerning from the city perspective, including mandates on allowable height, density, and parking, on the limitation to a single, largely meaningless opportunity for residents to learn about a project, and on the removal of resident ability to effectively appeal to their elected leaders with concerns. And lastly, how this bill continues to use the same broad brush approach across the entire state, despite stark differences in cities. Today, I'd like to specifically focus on the practical reality of this proposed bill in small to mid-sized greater Minnesota cities. First off, I want to say that I respect the intention to allow multifamily housing and commercial zones that allow considerations for water, sewer, and storm sewer infrastructure. The practical reality in Greater Minnesota is that we have limited commercial space in cities that already have small footprints. We often have a few big or mid-box stores, some nominal strip mall type locations, and parking. And or we have a small downtown business district. In either one of these settings, an apartment building likely does not belong, but I understand that's what's being debated here. Where the real concern exists is in the mandate that this use be allowed in combination with a restriction on parking minimums. This legislation does not simply reduce parking minimums, it eliminates them. In Cambridge, we have incredibly limited transportation options, and overwhelmingly, our residents have cars. To place incredibly dense housing into spaces, whether current commercial or multifamily zoned, and then not hold that developer responsible for managing the parking needs of their residents will create problems for decades to come. City streets in Cambridge are not wide enough to sustain on-street parking, particularly for the density described in this bill. This would strain the existing system and dramatically increase the cost to build new or replace existing as wider roads are put in place. This would lead to property tax increases. Yes, sir.
Sorry, we're running short on time now, and I've let you go about 30 seconds over. If you could please conclude your comments here so I can get the rest of our testifiers through today.
Absolutely. One sentence here, and then I'll wrap up. Thank you. This would lead to property tax increases throughout the state as well as more public space dedicated to roads and on-street parking, which would lead to compounding problems for snow removal, street sweeping, stormwater management, and road maintenance. I'm asking all members to oppose House File 2018 and oppose efforts to restrict local decision-making and authority. I'm happy to respond if there are any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Vogel. Next on the list will be Susan Arntz. Please unmute yourself and introduce yourself for the record.
Good afternoon. I'm Susan Arntz, and I serve as the city manager for the city of Mankato, and I'm testifying on behalf of the city and the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities. Affordable housing is a huge priority for our community. It's our number one strategic priority. We are a community of more than 17,600 housing units, with 50% of them being multifamily. Many cities in Greater Minnesota, including Mankato, allow residential mixed-use construction in some commercial areas. When determining whether a site is suitable for residential development, there are many important questions a city does consider beside whether the land is just available. We want to ensure that residents have safe access to parks and playgrounds, as well as routes to schools and services. Not every commercial lot is suitable for housing, and cities need to be part of this discussion. We are not the villains. I heard earlier in this hearing that where we choose to place housing matters. We agree. We appreciate the removal of the industrial areas. We do, however, have commercial areas adjacent to railroads in Mankato, and feel the current language does not allow us to consider the proximity to a railroad in our lens of reviewing a project administratively. With the exemption of consideration of traffic and noise for developments smaller than 300 units, that eliminates almost all of the development in Greater Minnesota. More specifically, we feel that proximity to railroads should be considered as an add somewhere in this bill. We are concerned about removing parking minimums and relying on developers to provide it on their own. I know that the market will dictate the number of parking spaces they feel they need for their residents, but I've experienced both in Waconia and in Mankato the lack of parking provided for guests, employees of state licensed group homes, senior caregivers, Meals on Wheels delivery, etc. The developers will long be gone when those issues arise, and in many cases, little can be done to address it. While this bill does not allow cities to require more than one neighborhood meeting, sometimes they do take more than one meeting, one to listen and one to come back to share changes. Neighborhood meetings improve projects. Mankato doesn't require them. We do encourage them. And in all cases, when they have taken place, the project is better. Removing them weakens community engagement. And we're asking you not to take the community out of community development. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Arntz. Is there anyone from the public that wishes to testify? Please come to the front and introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Chair Igo and members of the committee. I thought I was on the list today, but apparently I must have gotten missed. My name is Jason Waddell. I'm the city manager for the city of Prior Lake.
I'm a licensed civil engineer, and I'm also the former director of land development for a national home builder here in the Twin Cities. But today I'm here testifying on behalf of the 18 cities that make up the Municipal Legislative Commission, where approximately 80% of the new construction of homes is occurring in the Twin Cities. We respectfully request that you would oppose this bill. Requiring cities to allow residential housing in our commercial zoned areas is very problematic, especially the provision of this bill where it does not require any mixed use for residential in commercially zoned areas that's new greenfield construction. So in Prior Lake, 40% of our city hasn't even been built yet. We have a lot of areas that are zoned for future commercial. Those would now be potentially all residential, and we would lose all of that future commercial tax base. We're a city of 95% residential, 5% commercial tax base. Losing any commercial is a big deal. It's going to force our residents to get into their cars and drive to adjacent communities just to get their basic goods and services. It means that any budget increases that we have as a city hits our homeowners. And it's going to especially hurt our low-income homeowners and especially those that are on fixed incomes because we don't have the commercial tax base to spread those costs across. We've also heard from our school districts about how important it is to maintain our commercial tax bases for their financial needs. The 75-foot building height is also a concern for us. That would be 30 feet taller than any building in the city of Prior Lake that exists today. And then when you add in the affordability component, you could have a 110-foot tall building in the city of Prior Lake, where currently the tallest building is 45 feet, completely out of scale with anything we have, and we are not equipped from a public safety standpoint to maintain that. Parking, no parking requirements is a concern. We had a recent, within the last few years, a senior housing project subsidized, 186 units. They didn't want to put in as much parking as we were requiring. So we actually capitulated. We said, you are the experts. You know what your people need. Since it's been built, we as a city have gotten complaints every single year from the people that live in that building because there's not enough parking. And when we talked to the developers, they admitted that they underestimated the parking needs. And lastly, the administrative approvals. Not having planning commission or city council meetings, this bill silences the voice of our citizens on a new project that could potentially be a 110-foot tall building next to their properties, and they don't have input on it. So thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Seeing that, we'll go into member questions here. We just have a few minutes left. We can run a few minutes over members, but let's try to keep it brief. First on this will be Representative Mamanya Hiltzley.
Thank you so much, Chair Ego. It's just a comment that I want to make really quickly here, and I want to thank the young lady, I think it was Ms. Young, for basically being here and giving her personal testimony, because sometimes I think that when we sit at this decision-making tables and when we haven't had those lived experiences, we might be limited in our ability to make sound policies. So I definitely want to thank her for her testimony. And it's also my hope, Representative, that this bill will ensure that affordability of housing investments not only expand equitable access, but also prevent displacements, particularly in historically underserved communities, and that there is accountability measures put in place to ensure that funds directly benefit low-income renters and first-time home buyers. Thank you so much, Chair.
Thank you, Representative. Next will be Representative Rehrauer.
Thank you, Chair. Comment, I just want to share, not surprisingly, we have a lot of former and our current city council members and city administrators in the housing committee room today. I'm also a former city council member of Coon Rapids the last 4 years, and unfortunately, I saw a lot of the same issues we kind of talked about today take place there, despite a shortage of housing in the state and the need for workforce housing. I saw the majority in the council vote no on a number of housing development projects where a zoning code needed to be changed to allow for it. It included apartments, townhomes, and even a single family home development unless they had an HOA with that. One of these, very interestingly, was on the corner of Northdale Boulevard and Foley Boulevard. A developer had a great plan for This isn't where we have an aging strip mall right now. And a developer had a great plan for a small retail space with an apartment complex and surrounded by townhomes. And the majority on the council voted it down. And the strip mall is still there, and it's debilitated. And it currently, I would guess, about a 75% vacancy rate. I'm almost done. So there seems to be a desire for the status quo. Not every council, but some, many. But unfortunately, the status quo isn't working, which is why we need to allow, again, this is not requiring the development of multifamily. It's just allowing the development, and the market will make sure that these are done in reasonable places, because if it's right next to a salvage yard, likely nobody would rent that place, so a developer won't develop there. So I urge a yes vote on this bill.
Thank you, Representative. Lead Howard.
I'll be very quick since we're short on time. Thank you, Representative Kozlowski, for a multi-year effort on this multifamily bill. The couple things I just wanted to mention, I was really struck by the testimony today by Ms. Bennett, Mr. Hale, and Ms. Larson, folks that are looking to help develop housing border to border all across the state, but are all saying, you know, the same thing, that the current system creates too many barriers, too much red tape, and it's having an impact. We need to listen to folks from border to border who are saying that we can make changes that will improve things. And then the other piece of testimony that I thought was so valuable was hearing from our folks in Florida that have implemented some of these changes. And, you know, we've heard a lot of really scary things about what these bills could mean from our city folks. Well, Florida's done these things, and it didn't sink into the Atlantic Ocean. What they've seen is more homes be built. And we can take that good learnings and continue to develop this bill and help us meet what I think we all share is the desire to build more homes. So thank you for your work, and thanks for the discussion.
Representative Kozlowski, to your bill.
All right. Thank you, Chair and members. And I really appreciate the robust conversation that we've had. And even just looking at this lineup, as we joked yesterday about the logos, but I think also getting folks in this room and continuing these conversations who otherwise wouldn't is only going to make a better product. I think it's really clear, as we've been having conversations today and in this committee, that people and families of all age across Minnesota are looking for housing of all types that they can afford in, that they can grow old in and downsize to. Families like mine can go from, you know, renting and being in subsidized housing as well to first-gen home owners. Everybody wants to have that as a reality for our neighbors. I also was struck by testimony from our testifiers Young and Hale to Franco, who's building housing, and our laborers to Florida, where they're cranking out 30,000 units in 2 years. This is setting the stage and building what we can do if we say yes to the Transforming Main Streets Act today and pass this into law. This bill is about helping people and communities and make sure that our businesses thrive. Minnesota needs more housing, and right now, I can't tell you the amount of conversations that I'm sure that you all had of, hey, I wish we could repurpose that pharmacy, or I wish we could repurpose that restaurant and put it back onto the tax rolls. And the reality is that we can, and it's happening in places like Ely, Lanesboro, Red Wing, Stillwater to Duluth. This bill will incentivize more of that. You know, Ely was just named the most charming city to visit, and think about we heard about height and infrastructure and these things that we built in. We think about 75 feet, that's a pine tree. When you're the gateway to the Boundary Waters, those are the kind of communities we want to be building. Mixed use with coffee shops and childcare centers. These are the places that 72% of Minnesotans say they want to live in, and I think we can give it to them. So the Transforming Minnesota Main Street Act will not only build more homes, it will change education outcomes, healthcare outcomes, transform our downtowns, help bolster and expand businesses, and enhance our communities. And I ask for your support and a yes vote, members.
With that, Representative Kozlowski renews their motion that House File 2018, as amended by the A3 Amendment, be re-referred to the Elections, Finance, and Government Operations Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. That concludes our business for the day, members. Our plan is to meet next Tuesday, March 18th at 3 p.m. With that, we are adjourned.